We want an economy that is strong. That means you can fill up your tank. You can buy the groceries. You have enough money left over to go to Disneyland.
Republicans roll out new messaging on the economy 6 weeks out from the midterms. It's Friday, September 23rd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy outlined the Republican agenda today in Pennsylvania, a state home to maybe the most watched Senate race this year. He said the GOP's commitment to America includes more money for police and less for the IRS. Every Friday, we get together a few smart folks for our politics roundtable. And today, Peter O'Dowd and Don Gagne talked to NBC senior congressional reporter Scott Wong and Holly Otterbein, Politico's national political reporter based in Philadelphia.
All right, Holly, we're going to start with you. Pennsylvania has always been important in any big election. Help us understand what's at stake this time around.
Well, there's a reason that Kevin McCarthy is here today, and there's a reason that Donald Trump and Joe Biden have already made visits to Pennsylvania in the post-Labor Day period when you think of the general election really taking off. And that's because of all of the competitive races here. There's really no state like it. You've got the Pennsylvania Senate race, which is an open seat currently held by a Republican that's retiring between John Fetterman and Dr. Oz, these two big personalities. You've got a governor's race where the right to an abortion and the right for voters to have a free and fair election is really on the ballot with a far-right Republican versus the current attorney general. And then you've got a number of House races as well that are up for grabs, three or four or five, depending on how you look at it. Everyone is coming here because it's such a pivotal state, which it always is.
Let's go to the Senate race in Pennsylvania. At an event in Scranton last weekend, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who's running for Senate, he's the Democrat, addressed the fact that he suffered a stroke back in May.
A stroke that could have taken my life. You know, the issues now that's left, the only issue, is a lingering issue of auditory processing.
And he kind of turned it into a joke and a jab at his opponent, Republican Mehmet Oz, the celebrity TV doctor. Scott, what are Democrats in Washington saying about Fetterman's health and how that's playing into the race?
Well, you know, they're circling the wagons. I caught up with a number of Pennsylvania Democrats on the Hill, Madeline Dean, Mary Gay Scanlon, Bob Casey. They have all been campaigning with Fetterman in recent days and weeks, and they say that he looks great. He's getting better every day. They acknowledge that he has obviously had these health issues, but they say he's improving. And, you know, Fetterman has been taking attacks from Dr. Oz specifically about his health in recent weeks in campaign ads. And, Dr. Oz has challenged him to a debate and saying that he's scared to debate him. Well, Fetterman recently has agreed to an October 25th debate. If that in fact happens and they can hammer out some of the details of that debate, that will really allow voters, I think, to have a side-by-side comparison and for people to better evaluate what Fetterman's health really is. I'll also point out, I mean, in the Congress, there are a number of older individuals in the House and Senate, three folks leading the House of Representatives in their 80s. And so health issues have always been an issue for members of Congress. And that's no different here with John Fetterman.
Well, let's listen to. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, why don't you go ahead.
I was just going to jump in and say, I think for the Oz campaign, it seems like the focus on Fetterman's health and debates and this, you know, debate about debates and will Fetterman commit to a debate, which, yes, he said he would do one, but now, you know, Oz is saying that's not enough. I think it's mostly a media strategy. Oz was getting all of these bad headlines because Fetterman was trolling him online as like an out-of-touch New Jersey carpetbagger. Oz has really changed that in the last few weeks and been able to change the media conversation into more of one about Fetterman and debates and his health. When you look at the advertising that Oz and his Republican allies are doing in Pennsylvania, it's mostly about crime. So you see that's actually where they're putting their money. And that's where they think, you know, it'll affect voters.
Holly, just about a month ago, Oz was said to be struggling. Are you saying that he's regaining his footing here somewhat, or what?
So the polls haven't really shown that much of a difference in the last, you know, few weeks in the Senate race. But I think he's picked up a little bit of momentum in other ways that they hope the polls will reflect soon. You know, changing the media conversation, like I talked about, on, you know, the crime ads. They've been painting Fetterman as soft on crime. Fetterman, you know, clearly thinks that this is having an impact because he's put out a few of his own spots reacting to that and saying, actually, you know, he's fought crime as the former mayor of a steel town in western Pennsylvania. So that's, you know, at the very least, a better place for Oz to be than he was, a month or two ago when all the headlines were about Fetterman trolling Oz and about Republicans having doubts about Oz. Republicans are feeling a little bit more optimistic about the Senate race.
And Holly, while we've got you, what about the governor's race in Pennsylvania? One poll last week showed Republican state senator Doug Mastriano was essentially tied with his Democratic opponent, State Attorney General Josh Shapiro. You've written that Mastriano is kind of the archetype Christian nationalist in the GOP. Shapiro, you've also written, is the kind of guy people say, hey, he could be the first Jewish president, but he's got to win this gubernatorial race first. How are things playing out right now?
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of the Senate race, or at least it's a different thing going on where, you know, yes, there are a lot of polls that are coming out. You just mentioned one that was closer. Overall, we've seen Shapiro open up his lead against Mastriano. At the beginning of the summer, when the primary first ended, it was very tight. Democrats were getting pretty nervous. They thought that Shapiro was really going to have this in the bag. And here, you know, these polls were showing basically them within the margin of error. Recently, Shapiro's, you know, been ahead in the polling averages by double digits. And I think that is primarily because Mastriano has not put a single general election ad on air. So Shapiro is hitting him with these really harsh attacks, you know, as extremist, as, tied to white nationalists, and, you know, very staunchly anti-abortion with no exceptions. And Mastriano is not responding at all on TV. And so I think you're seeing that have a really big impact right now. Now, Mastriano said recently that he is going to put up ads soon, but it's really late. I mean, this is the end of September, you know, and just briefly, I think the reason that he, you know, has had trouble with fundraising is, you know, he is very anti-establishment. And so all of those sort of traditional GOP donors really have abandoned him.
That's The View from Pennsylvania. Scott Wong, I want to bring you in here. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, we just heard from him at the top there, says that Republicans will have a disciplined messaging schedule, a single message each week on fossil fuel production, on crime, on immigration leading up to the elections on November 8th. What do you think the challenges are that he faces in doing that from within his own party?
Well, if you actually look at the actual platform itself, this commitment to America, it does not include a lot of specifics. You know, in terms of abortion, they lay out, you know, the lines that they lay out say, we are for protecting the lives of unborn children. But what does that really mean? And herein lies the challenge of laying out an agenda, of laying out policy specifics, because across the other side of the Capitol, Lindsey Graham tried to do just that, you know, proposing a ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. That was shot down by a number of his fellow senators who thought that, you know, that was the wrong approach and went too far and didn't want to get involved in an intra-party debate over abortion, especially as Democrats really see that as an energizing and winning issue ahead of the midterm. So there is a big risk of laying out, you know, specific policy proposals. I think Kevin McCarthy is trying to walk this tightrope of saying, this is what we stand for broadly without getting too specific. He is leaning on the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who, as you guys remember, authored the contract with America. If the commitment to America sounds familiar, it's because it was taken from the contract of with America back in 1994 when Republicans won the House of Representatives in those midterms for the first time in 40 years. So McCarthy trying to, get some of that Newt Gingrich magic and repeat history in these midterm elections.
All right. Scott Wong is senior congressional reporter for NBC News and Holly Otterbein, national political reporter for Politico. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend, both of you.
You too.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's Banned Books Week, and we heard from you about what's going on in your school districts. We've been talking about efforts to ban books all week, and we asked you for your stories about how the fight over which books make it into school libraries is playing out in your communities. We've heard from parents and teachers across the country, and you'll hear a few of them in this conversation Peter O'Dowd had with Jonathan Friedman. He's with the group PEN America, and he wrote a report called Banned in the USA, The Growing Movement to Censor Books in Schools.
And we'll get to our listeners in just a moment. But first of all, one of my takeaways from this report is that there are communities in this country that are on fire over this issue. How do you see it?
Well, I see it as an uptick in not only calls to remove books from schools, but in particular in the organization and coordination of it as a growing movement, as we called it in the report. There have been demands and challenges to books in schools for decades, but there is something different taking place right now. There are groups online who are trying to coordinate and encourage people to bring their concerns, not just to bring them to school boards, but to bring them in a kind of adamant, uncompromising fashion.
We're going to get to all of that, but first, let's bring in some of our listeners. We heard from a lot of teachers, including Adam Byrne Tritt, who teaches high school English in Brevard County, Florida.
I have had books in my classroom library that I had to pull off my shelves. Poetry books, such as Emily Dickinson. I've had books I've used for years that I had to stop using. There are things which I am mandated to teach, but I must develop lesson plans for carefully, such as Shakespeare's The Tempest, which I must somehow teach without ever bringing up the concept of colonialism or color, so that I do not make any student uncomfortable in any way.
Now, we heard a lot about this, the idea that even many classics that have been taught for years in schools are causing conflict. How common is that across the country?
Well, I think this is very common. You know, the idea that is behind a lot of these bans is that essentially any parent who's objecting about anything ought to be able to take that objection into action. In other words, that book that they don't like ought to be restricted from everybody. And that is what is causing so much chaos and difficulty for a lot of schools, which have historically run, you know, with a degree of trust and expertise vested in teachers. It doesn't mean that there aren't channels and there shouldn't be channels for parents to raise these concerns, but it's an extreme to jump to, I don't like this book, therefore nobody should be able to read it. And that seems to be what's common in many teachers' and librarians' experiences.
Okay, let's hear from a student. This is high school junior Alexandra Coffey, who says her Central Bucks School District in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, has recently come up with very restrictive book policies, particularly on gender identity and race. Here she is.
I am deeply concerned by the negative effects that this policy will have on our Black, Brown, and queer students. If these students, my friends and I, we can't read about people that think like us, look like us, love like us, what kind of negative effects will this have? My biggest question would be, how is all of this legal?
That's a good question. Is it legal?
Well, there was an interpretation that was offered by Supreme Court Justice William J. Brennan when he considered the precise pattern of facts that is common now among many school districts. And he said that school libraries ought to function in conjunction with the First Amendment. And that means that they cannot be places where the government is engaged in the official suppression of ideas. So think about this for a second. You have people who are bringing complaints, often targeted against books just because they have LGBTQ identities or because they represent some perspective on race or racism, or sometimes they're just books with protagonists of color that people are objecting to. And then you have government officials, whether it's school administrators or it's school board members, who are reacting and saying, you're right, something is wrong with this book. We need no due process. We don't need to read these books. Let's just remove them right away. And that is what Justice Brennan raised concerns about, and that would be unconstitutional. And this came out of the Pico v. Island Trees court case in 1982.
Well, here's another point of view. One of our listeners, Alexia Duke, a mother of three, whose kids go to school in Lexington, Massachusetts, did express some frustration with curriculum. She wrote into us and she said that she has three kids in the public school system, and through the years, their reading lists have become almost exclusively non-white, non-heterosexual, and non-Western. She goes on to say that she understands there are different points of view regarding the Western canon and its place in our students' education, but that an English course shouldn't be exclusively concerned with political debates and social justice issues. Just hoping you could weigh in on that.
Well, I think that democracy is about openness, and that ought to be reflected in our schools. I worry that what we're seeing right now with the censorious climate that is taking shape is that a lot of teachers are going to, instead of pushing students, instead of bringing up things that might be controversial or often, frankly, speak to the world they live in, they're going to opt for lessons that are more anodyne or less relevant for the sake of avoiding controversy. And so what should English class be about? You know, this is a question that people have been debating for a long time, and that debate is healthy. Let's continue that debate. But censorious responses to this, you know, prohibitions, that's no way to solve disagreements about these questions. Mm-hmm.
One of our listeners mentioned a dark chapter in history that began with book banning. Let's hear what Alan Cohen of Winterport, Maine, had to say.
Banning books leads to ignorance, and banning and burning books is how the Nazi Party started their repression of rights and then genocide. Banning books does nothing to increase knowledge or tolerance. In fact, it does the opposite.
So Alan here is making a comparison to the Nazis. Are the stakes that high? I mean, is that a fair comparison at this point?
Well, I don't think at this point we are seeing, you know, things that approach Nazism, but there are certainly troubling developments, whether it's death threats against teens who want to run programs in public libraries, the cancellation of events in schools and libraries because of pressure from one small group of people, the threat of violence. In Idaho recently there was reports of people complaining about library books and coming with guns to do so. So my hope is that these disagreements about schools and books and libraries can be resolved through a degree of dialogue and a degree of process. But unfortunately, that has not been the case. Our research and report recently released says that over 90% of the cases where we have found book banning, it's because it's a result of not going through processes. And that it's the erosion of that process that we're seeing that's really quite disturbing.
Let's talk for a moment about who is behind much of this. Chandler Geese is a public school teacher in Louisville, Kentucky. He's pointing this out. He says what he sees in his community goes far beyond the attempt to ban books.
There's groups like the American Family Association of Kentucky going around to different churches saying that the homosexuals are coming for your children, that public schools are not making your children Christian, therefore they basically have to go. And so it's not about banning books. It's about riling up people for a political movement that is anti-public school, anti-education, anti-literacy, and backed by major donors.
Jonathan, weigh in on this. Talk about the groups. American Majority, Patriot Mobile, Moms for Liberty, who we've spoken to this week, and perhaps others. They're not just attending school board meetings, but they're joining the school board. Have we ever seen this level of involvement before?
I think this is something new, an effort to really make local school board meetings political in a new way, in injecting, you know, a particular ideology that often appears to be pretty extreme and, you know, very narrow into controlling public schools. And, you know, a lot of the groups here, I would say, are actually different. Some of them seem to be more oriented to conservative values, some to more Christian values. Some are groups that, you know, have very clear anti-LGBTQ animus. And some are clearly formed, you know, in the wake of the pandemic and have objections over that. And so when you speak to teachers and librarians around the country, it's essentially the same story just about everywhere. People shouting at school board meetings, people being doxxed or harassed or having people come to their houses. But it's my greatest concern also here that there's been so much undermining of respect for teachers and librarians. You know, what teacher or librarian deserves to have their entire career ruined over a book?
One more piece of tape here. I mentioned I'd spoken with a member of one of these groups. This is Tiffany Justice, co-founder of Moms for Liberty. She told me that she was concerned that young school children could get their hands on books with sexually explicit or graphic content. Here she is.
Parents are saying, what is going on here? Why is this very sexually explicit content being pushed down into lower and lower grades? Why do people want to talk to our children in kindergarten at the age of 5 when they still believe in the tooth fairy?
Now, the truth is that some of the books in question here do have sexually explicit content in them. So how would you tell parents to navigate this situation?
Well, I think what we have to do is develop a shared language here. There's a lot of words being bandied about: sexually explicit, pornographic, obscene. A lot of the books that are getting these labels are literary classics, and I've seen it said that the books have no literary merit, you know, just because they have some kind of sexual content in them whatsoever. And we have to remember that we're talking about, in many cases, teenagers who might be sexually active. We're talking about young people who also have a right to access information about themselves, about their bodies. And it is in the absence of education and information where people are, you know, more likely to be taken advantage of. The other thing is that right now, a lot of cases where the books are being targeted for removal because of their sexual content, it's books that have LGBTQ content that are trying to reach LGBTQ youth, many of whom live in unsafe home environments, and books and libraries and schools are a lifeline for them. And so we have to hear those voices in this too. And so we have to be aware of all of these factors and these rights when we think about how schools can mediate these decisions.
Jonathan Friedman is director of Free Expression and Education Programs at PEN America, also lead author of a report that came out this week on the rise of banned books in the U.S. We're going to link you to it at hereandnow.org. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can hear all our conversations on banned books at hereandnow.org. After the break, you really can't fathom how many ants there are on Earth. But some scientists have tried. Okay, this is one of those questions you might hear a curious kid ask, or that you might wonder rhetorically without thinking you'd actually get an answer. How many ants are there? Well, scientists gave it their best shot and published the results this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The answer? 20 quadrillion. That's the number 20 with 15 zeros after it. Don Gagne asked University of Gloucestershire entomologist Adam Hart to make sense of it.
I don't even know if I have a first question, except to say that's a lot of ants. What gives?
It's a colossal number, for sure. Combined together, the biomass of ants is greater than the biomass of all wild and mammals and birds, for example. And they would weigh about 20%, about a fifth of all of the humans on the planet.
I'm picturing an anthill the size of Vesuvius. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be that sort of magnitude, right? Bigger, if anything.
So how were scientists able to come up with this, clearly an estimate?
What's actually happened here is that about 500 studies have been done of ant populations and ant numbers in different types of habitats and different ecosystems and of different types of ants and so on. And what the researchers have done is drawn together all of those studies and surveys and to try and use those baseline studies as estimates of how many ants there could be out there. So yes, it's an estimate.
People are probably familiar with the nuisance of carpenter ants, but there is a lot more to ants than meets the eye.
I've seen these ants do great things. And year after year, they somehow manage to pick food for themselves and you.
Okay, that's a clip from the Pixar movie, A Bug's Life. Adam, what do ants actually do in the wild, and why are they important?
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I guess we've got two aspects, really. The first is that every ant species we know is highly social. So when you find an ant, a worker ant walking around on the pavement or whatever, and you follow it, it will take you back to a nest. And in some species, those nests can be huge. The leaf-cutting ants in South America can have 8 million ants within them. Some of the big driver ant colonies in Africa can have over 20 million. So these are very social animals with highly organized societies. They're getting an awful lot of complex work done in a very, very organized way. And that has two effects. One, it makes us look at them and go, wow, which is no small thing. Mm-hmm. But the second thing that it means is that they are ecologically very important. The ants that live in the soil have these wonderful nests underground that aerate soil, structures soil, and of course they bring material from the surface down, which is involved in nutrient cycling. So that's an important thing that they do. Ants themselves, the majority of them are predators, which means they're out there on our crops, they're out there in our gardens, and they're out there in the natural world keeping on top of different types of, I guess we would call them pests in this context, they would call them prey. They have an incredibly important role as predators, which sort of strangely, counterintuitively, actually increases biodiversity. By having predators like ants in a system, you get much more biodiverse ecosystems in terms of invertebrates and things. So they have a really important role out there ecologically. They are, if we think of insects as the glue that holds the ecosystem together, ants are almost kind of the super glue. You know, they're involved in all kinds of different interactions that are of real significance.
Give us an ant fact that everyone should know.
Okay, well, here's a nice one. Quite a few species of ants we know can navigate using the Earth's magnetic fields. So they can actually find their way around with an internal compass that we're only just beginning to understand that involves tiny magnetic crystals in their brain interacting with their nervous system and letting them know where they're going. So I guess in a sense you could say that ants have an inbuilt GPS system, which is at least as sophisticated as anything that we've come across in the natural world. And yeah, we have yet to find out precisely how it works. They are quite remarkable.
Does it tell them there's a shorter route here that will save them 2 minutes?
Well, no, they have a whole other system for doing that. We could go into that too. So they've got a whole chemical system that creates on the ground effectively like a chemical solution to a maize problem, all based on different rates of evaporation and so on. So actually, yeah, they've got that nailed down as well.
Okay, that's Professor of Science Communication and entomologist Adam Hart. Adam, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, pleasure.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. We've got a lot more from our radio show at hereandnow.org. Check out producer Karen Miller-Medson's reporting from Honduras, where a nonprofit is working to get children's books into schools plagued by gang violence.
Even a whole neighborhood can be controlled by a gang. And by control, I mean who comes into the neighborhood, who goes out. The gang itself might cancel classes one day because something's going down in the neighborhood.
You can hear that and a lot more at hereandnow.org. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Adeline Sear, and Gabrielle Healy. Todd Munt, Jill Ryan, and Tinku Ray edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike and Max, along with me, Chris Bentley. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back Monday.